This war has to end.
That's what incumbent Joe Biden said last year, just weeks into his presidency, announcing an end to U.S. assistance for Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen, as well as relevant arms sales. However, months later, that promise was broken as his government approved two arms deals worth over $1 billion. To support the United Arab Emirates against Yemen's retaliatory attacks, the U.S. is now deploying a destroyer and fighter jets in the UAE, a key member of the Saudi-led military coalition. France also says it will give military support to the UAE to help it protect its airspace. The Biden administration is also planning to bring Yemen's Ansarullah movement back on a U.S. blacklist. Aid organizations warn that the move would prevent the delivery of critical humanitarian assistance to millions of innocent people and could have adverse humanitarian consequences.
It will have much effect on Yemeni civilians, because many UN agency and NGOs are working in Yemen. If the United States will continue, or if they will declare the Houthi as a terrorist group, this will have a huge and a bad effect on Yemeni civilians.
By sticking to warmongering policies, the current U.S. president is also missing on his chances to stop the war, a conflict that the UN says has already turned Yemen into the largest humanitarian crisis in the world.
The European Union Agency for Asylum, EUAA, says new refugee applications in the 27-country bloc are at a five-year high, mainly being submitted by Afghans and Syrians. On Wednesday, 19 refugees were found dead on the border between Turkey and EU nation Greece. It's believed they died from hypothermia. The European Commission claims it's trying to gather further information. EU Home Affairs ministers have been meeting to try and advance the bloc's new refugee policy, known as the Migration Pact.
The strategy of all or nothing up to now has actually given us nothing, and this is not good for member states or the European Union. We want to breathe new life into the EU Migration Pact.
When it comes to the refugee crisis, civil society organizations and many EU lawmakers make the point that the West never learns from its mistakes. They are expressing concern that stoking tensions with Russia over Ukraine has the potential to create a new refugee crisis. It's suggested war hawks in the US and NATO don't give a damn about the millions of people who have been displaced through military intervention in countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and Libya. As the EU's Poland and Lithuania construct a new wall along their borders with Belarus, the European Commission is promising billions of euro to expand and arm the bloc's border agency, Frontex.
Frontex is by far the biggest agency we ever had. And we are setting it up right now, and it's huge. It's going to have 10,000 armed people at our external borders.
The EU's own data shows 100,000 children and teenagers go missing in the bloc every year. Most of those are refugees. Campaigners are calling for greater cooperation between police forces.
There need to be better information sharing platforms so we know exactly how many children are going missing and what are the actual risks that they face, because right now, nobody knows.
With EU nations refusing to take in refugees, and as billions are spent on keeping them out, rights groups are again asking, where are the bloc's much trumpeted values? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In overcrowded dinghies and often in the cover of darkness, migrants, among them people running away from wars and instability, take to the choppy waters separating France from the UK. Some make it. Others die trying. 27 of them in November last year alone. An incident that further strained the fragile ties between Paris and London. French President Emmanuel Macron says Britain's reliance on illegal immigrant labor is behind the surge in numbers crossing from France and in their deaths.
I think it's definitely political, because he's getting set to run his election campaign. You know, we've had Brexit as well, so we know that that has impacted, but the reality is we're talking about human beings. So this is not about political point scoring or it shouldn't be about political point scoring between governments.
Britain says the French president is absolutely wrong, that the government here is searching for ways to stop the crossings. This is what Interior Minister Priti Patel had to say in the wake of those tragic deaths in November.
We're not working just to end these crossings because we don't care or we're heartless. There's no quick fix. This is about addressing long-term pull factors, smashing criminal gangs that treat human beings as cargo, and tackling supply chains.
To do that, Britain wants France to let British police patrol French beaches. It has ruled out physically pushing boats back across the English Channel. It wants to give people traffickers life sentences and has introduced a controversial bill that will allow it to send migrants to detention centers in other countries. To campaigners, that is draconian and racist.
The Nationality and Borders Bill seeks to make it even more difficult for people to seek asylum in Britain, which again is a contravening international human rights laws. It will also mean that there's a higher scrutiny of people. There are tighter deadlines as it stands.
More than 28,000 migrants crossed the English Channel in 2021, triple the number the year before.
And while British and French leaders continue to trade accusations, more desperate migrants will embark on that perilous journey across the English Channel, and that will almost certainly mean more deaths. Saeed Pourriza, London.
It is the revolution that continues to reverberate around the globe. Iran's Islamic Revolution ushering in a new age by ousting the US-backed Pahlavi regime. Father Frank Gehli, who became an ordained minister, recalls his initial reaction when news of the revolution broke.
At the time, I considered myself quite left-wing, so I enjoyed the idea there should be a revolution against the Shah. So I considered the Shah a tyrant.
One of the most inspirational things about the Islamic Revolution for its many admirers is not just the impact that it's had inside of Iran, but it's the growing legacy that it continues to build globally. For political observers, Iran's stoic path proved an innovative and bold new model where alliances could be forged and solidarity fostered.
Because of its anti-imperialistic values, that's why Iran has good relations with lots of other countries around the world, Muslim and non-Muslim, that have also suffered colonialism and occupation. I mean, it could be Cuba, it could be Venezuela, many countries in Africa around the world who, you know, have a certain affinity with Iran because of that.
There's also another element to those who admire the aims and accomplishments of the revolution.
The Iranian revolution, as I mentioned, it tells us how you don't have to have only one model of political system whereby, I mean, here in this country, we have a monarch who is head of a national church, but it's a farce. In reality, God has been pushed out of a public sphere. And so the whole thing is a charade. In Iran, there is a valuable presence of faith in the public sphere.
As the revolution moves towards another remarkable milestone, the West still continues its opposition campaign despite a lack of success.
I can't think of too many examples of countries around the world that have withstood the barrage of war, sanctions, media hatred, internal subterfuge, you know, kind of instigated from outside, that Iran has. Yet they're still here, and they're not just surviving by the skin of their teeth, they're thriving as well. They have a strong military, they have strong regional allies, they have political influence, especially within their area in the Middle East. I think that it's widely recognized, even by haters of Iran, that Iran is one of the major regional players.
With its legacy still rippling across the globe, supporters of the Islamic Revolution internationally know they owe Iran and Iranians a great debt. Amina Taylor, London.
Come April, many Britons will have to choose between heating and eating. Everything from bus fares to mortgages are going to cost more. Interest rates have gone up twice in 7 weeks, and three more hikes are on the horizon as the central bank tries to tackle the situation. The opposition members of parliament are livid, saying the government is incompetent.
He doesn't like it, Mr. Speaker, when children in my constituency go to bed with no food in their tummies, with no heat in their homes. What does he really think is the honourable position of a Chancellor who has just allowed one of his policies directly to be taken in fraud, £4.3 billion of fraud under his watch? Any other Chancellor that I've known would come to the House today to resign.
This week, millions learnt that their gas and electricity bills are going to jump 54%. The government says there's nothing it can do with energy prices going up worldwide.
I don't believe them at all. You know, I'm sure they know, you know, and this is just to put people more in poverty, you know. And it's not right, it's not fair, you know. People working very hard.
When you look at the price of things now, everything going up higher than it was. And that's why so many people on the street, living on the street, because they can't afford to eat or drink.
Well, I feel like it's government responsible to support people who are in this horrible situation. Because I had a problem this year myself. I couldn't find an apartment because the prices went up crazy twice.
Also causing inflation to rise is supply chain issues, higher import taxes and wages increasing. Brexit, the pandemic and a global energy crisis, a perfect storm for Britain, now in the grips of its worst economic slump in 300 years. But who will have to pay for it all?
On April 1st, the cost of living will be going up £3,000 a year for each household. On the very same day, British politicians will be getting a £2,000 a year pay rise. From this, it is clear that those that are on top of the pile have their bills covered, and it's those on the breadline that will be picking up those bills. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Epic, glory, honor. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy. See the world through IRIB English Radio, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Islamic Revolution, an Islamic Iranian model of progress. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are in the 10 days dawn, the period marking the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. The fundamental principle of the Islamic Revolution since its formation has been full independence on the blocks of the power in the world. The Islamic Iran has tried to move without the least dependence on the East or the West in different political, social, economic, and cultural arenas. However, One of the most prominent arenas in which Iran has made great progress is the production of sciences. A country which used to send students abroad to train specialists in various fields has reached the point that it is one of the famous poles in many fields of science, technology, and medicine. Pharmaceutical industry is one of the fields in which Iran has proved itself strong and effective. This industry has a past record of nearly 100 years, but it thrived after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. In fact, the pharmaceutical industry flourished during the eight-year imposed war in 1980s. Thus, after two decades of six factories were set up, which now have turned into producers of biotechnological medicines. Today, over 34 biomedicines are made in Iran, and some of them are exported to different countries. The medical and pharmaceutical achievements in Iran have urged research and media centers in the world to issue reports on these breakthroughs. Al Monitor website reported that after the 1979 revolution, Iran has taken praiseworthy strides in many spheres. Since 1980 to 2012, the Human Development Index, which deals with life length, access to education and living standards, has been 67% in Iran, which is double the global average. Dear friends, the Islamic Republic of Iran, after over four decades, has decided to accelerate its progresses in various domains. To this end, it has designed and implemented long-term plans. One of the most important plans that have been seriously dealt with during the recent years was the preparation of Islamic Iranian Model of Progress document. This upper hand document, indeed, is the roadmap for advancement in every field. Some believe that progress is possible only through imitation of the West, and that one should follow the course of the West to attain sciences and technology. Others maintain that due to deep differences and even contradictions between Islamic and Christian ideologies, the Western course and model of progress won't be feasible for an Islamic nation. This group correctly believes that the Western knowledge and technology will bring with it the Western ideology and lifestyle. There is a third group, which is of the opinion that Western knowledge and technology are the outcome of human intellect, and one can employ them by filtering them and making them compatible with the Islamic ideology. The Islamic Iranian Model of Progress has been designed and prepared through the participation of a big number of thinkers and experts in all fields. It has been compiled according to the Islamic outlook and principles and the values of the Islamic Revolution. It has also taken into consideration the social, ethnic, and cultural requirements of Iran. The document of Islamic Iranian Model of Progress makes it clear that till 1444, that is, 2065, Iran will be pioneer in production of humanities, Islamic sciences, and the lofty sciences all over the world. It adds that Iran will be among the five advanced nations in the world in the fields of production of thought, sciences, and technology. The country will enjoy knowledge-based economy, self-reliance, rationality, Islamic spirituality, and one of the 10 prominent economies across the globe. Within these years, maximum environment health, sustainability of natural resources, water, energy, and food security will be maintained. Poverty, corruption, and discrimination will be eradicated in the country, and comprehensive social security and easy access to judicial system will be provided for everybody. According to this document, in 2065, the Iranian nation will enjoy Islamic Iranian lifestyle which is based on jihadi spirit, law, protection of values, national identity, and Islamic Revolution heritage. Thus, the Iranian nation will be trained in the school of Prophet Muhammad and his infallible Ahl al-Bayt or progeny. They will achieve the highest degrees of spirituality, sciences, skills, and the job they like. Thus, they will enjoy security, calm, welfare, health, hope of life at a high level. In 2065, the Islamic Republic of Iran will be the center of many sciences in the region and the world. These points might sound far-fetched, but the progresses that Iran has made for the past four decades, in spite of cruel sanctions and round-the-clock conspiracies of enemies, make them accessible and viable. The Islamic Iranian Model of Progress is one of the most important documents, which requires active and inexhaustible endeavor of the young generation to come true. Ayatollah Khamenei says, "You youth consider yourselves responsible before the progress of the country." The Progress Program is a clear program. It is a thought-for and calculated program. You see that the model of Islamic Iranian progress, which can shape the way of movement in the country in various directions, has been explicated, determined, and prepared. It is in the hand of experts to fully examine it, to complete and perfect it. You too consider yourselves as part of the activities of this broad and comprehensive plan and prepare yourselves for it. This preparedness is one day with studying, one day with research, one day with building, one day is with the work and innovation, one day is with adoption of correct political stance, and one day is with presence in the field of politics. Every day and every period of your life has these requirements. Consider yourselves duty-bound to participate and to be responsible before the progress of the country in all circumstances.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
January 5th, 2022.
Pay attention to this fact, that the Islamic Republic is an Islamic government and its flag is the flag of Shi'ism. But even in the Islamic countries where Sunnis are living, sometimes people express their interest in the Islamic Republic. They express their interest, advocacy, cooperation and support. In many countries from East Asia to West Africa, there are those who look at the Islamic Republic in this way, but they are not Shia. Therefore, in the Islamic world today, the Islamic Republic is a manifestation of Islam, of the Islamic nation, and of the sovereignty of the Islamic nation. As I mentioned before, in countries in which many Sunnis live, the people held large demonstrations on the anniversary of the martyrdom of Shahid Soleimani. Therefore, we should not think that we are entitled to show negligence towards national solidarity. Of course, there are other points that I have mentioned before many times. For instance, boosting hope and looking to the future. This is one of the important issues of our time. There are some individuals who try to undermine hope in the youth and try to make them hopeless, distrustful of the future, and think that there are no prospects for them.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
It is our duty to strengthen hope in their hearts. Boosting hope cannot be done by just talking. It should be done by working hard. And the country's officials are thankfully busy and active. They should pay attention to the fact that many of their positive deeds can fill the hearts of the youth with hope. Their actions can fill the youth with hope and make them hopeful. When youth have hope, they will work well in various fields, they will study, and they will conduct research. One of these positive actions is preventing some people from taking moves in the opposite direction in trying to cause the youth to lose their hope. They do this using different temptations in the internet and other media. Another point is that we must not allow the achievements of the Islamic Republic to remain hidden. This is one of the very important issues. Well, we have economic problems today. For example, there are the problems of inflation, the expensive prices of some goods, the people's livelihood, especially the underprivileged classes, and problems with our banking system, taxes, and the like. Well, these are our problems. Some describe these problems as if nothing positive has happened in the Islamic Republic, and they conceal the achievements.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
Very grim assessment when it comes to the UK's energy bills and, in turn, its economy. Energy bills to rise by over 50% in the month of April, based on the regulator in the UK, which has announced price hikes. An estimated 22 million households will see their energy costs increase. Can these households afford that in the age of COVID? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why rising energy costs are not the only problems plaguing UK's economy, economy which has not been able to adapt itself since Brexit. Let's get the latest on this. Rob Carter is our correspondent joining us from London. Rob, at this point, looking at this increase of 50%, it's quite incredible. It is set to start in the month of April, but I was under the assumption that the energy costs have risen already. And of course, tell us what the government intends to do, because I think they do have a quick fix for this, in a sense.
Well, energy costs are just one aspect which people are concerned about here in the UK. The price of living in general is on the increase. You'll remember from past reporting that petrol prices are at least four times higher than they were the same time last year. There's also inflation taking place. People are having to pay more in order to get their day-to-day food groceries, among many other things. And this energy bill crisis is just the latest in a long line of increased living costs which are plaguing the country. It's reached a point now where people are very concerned about whether or not they can even pay off their mortgages, meaning that many people going forward may be in a position where they're going to have to choose between either eating a meal, paying their mortgage, or putting the heating on during the cold months. So the situation here is very concerning for the majority of people. The government, of course, is still chewing over what plans it's going to take in order to reduce this in the future. But it's the Chancellor and also the Bank of England have been very, very clear that going forward in the immediate terms, things are going to get hard for people. And the government is in no position to deny the fact that people are going to have to pay more, including an increase on immediate bills, including national insurance and things like that. Of course, there are other things which are coming into play over the next few months. Protest movements such as Insulate Britain, which have been long campaigning through direct action to try and force the government to insulate homes, to save people money on their bills and to keep people warm during the cold months. They've announced that they will return to their radical direct action plan going forward, and they intend to be more ambitious than they were last year. And this is the group which, of course, was shutting down motorways, causing major disruption across the UK, and has a very controversial legacy in itself, putting the government in more difficult waters as to dealing with this crisis. So obviously, going forward, things are likely to get harder rather than better.
We appreciate it. Okay, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. We have historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosselin joining us from Bristol. Also joining us, journalist and political commentator Sid Mohsen Abbas, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
So we have all UK cast here. That's great, in a sense. Tony Gosselin, let me start with you. We heard our correspondent there. I'm curious about this energy, rise in energy, in particular, I guess, when it comes to households and gas, set to increase by 50% based on the stat I'm looking at here. What's interesting here is that the Britain's energy regulator can cap the price, but it couldn't do it beyond the 50% rise. It couldn't cap it or bring down the price or lower it. Is that because the energy companies are privatized and therefore they can't set the price, and that's the best that it could do at this point, the energy regulator?
Well, in a way, you've put your finger on the main problem here, and that is that although they are supposed to be able to regulate the energy market, they can't regulate the energy market, because if all of the energy companies get together and hike up the price of gas, as they have done, so there's much more gas, American gas, going to China at the moment. And as Putin pointed out a couple of months ago, this is the main reason why these energy prices in Europe are going up, because they can't get as much easy, cheap gas as they were doing from the United States. And the fact that this sort of thing is left to the vagaries of a market actually has enabled these energy companies to make vast, vast profits. What we've seen just literally last week announced by Shell, a 14-fold increase, 14 times more profits and money going to their shareholders through share dividends than the previous quarter. So a massive amount of money is being made by these privatized energy companies. What, of course, should happen is that these industries, because they are misbehaving, profiteering off the backs of ordinary working people in Britain, they should be simply renationalised. They should be requisitioned by the government, and then they can start to actually charge the cost price, which is what these utilities should be charging for the energy that people are using. It was interesting. I was just looking at the when it was all privatised. This is the gas and also BP, the golden share in petroleum that was privatised in the Thatcher years. It was NM Rothschild and Sons that managed that privatisation. These are very powerful investment bankers. And you have to ask, who's in charge? We ask this all the time with Boris. Who's really running the show? And I think it shows you that the City of London has actually got far more power than the politicians that we elect, when they can be involved in lobbying and arranging for these industries, which we all need, part of our national assets under the ground, to be sold off to private interests. Then also, sure. I would say, we had a couple of months ago fuel shortages orchestrated during the party conference season by the petrol companies here in Britain. So queues outside petrol stations, there was no real fuel shortage. They were doing this deliberately to push the prices up, make more profits, as they've just announced they made, and also to show the world and show the country and show the politicians who's in charge. That is to say that these massive energy conglomerates backed by the City of London are far more powerful than our politicians, I'm afraid.
That's another angle to this, which is very interesting. We're going to get into that. Simon Abbas, taking a look at what is happening to the UK, starting with the topic at hand, which was the energy hike in prices. There's a vast array of, there's so many things that are going wrong for the UK, but this particular one hits UK households pretty hard. 22 million British households are connected to the country's gas grid. Can you give us your assessment of how vast the problem this is?
Well, I think on the ground, it's a huge problem, because, you know, those at the poverty-stricken end, and there's substantial numbers of those in Britain, are going to feel a pinch immediately, because when you're talking about this scale of hike in prices, of course, people are going to then have to make choices, and the kind of choices they're making are, do I keep my heating on, or do I eat food? I mean, these are literally the decisions that many, say, pensioners or people who are unemployed or people who have been, you know, down and out for a while on their luck are having to make. And this is a situation that was entirely avoidable because, you know, of course, we've had the debacle of Brexit, which was a premeditated self-annihilation exercise that Boris was personally very much involved in creating. We've had the supposed Omicron virus preceded by the Delta, preceded by COVID, whatever else it was in its very initiation, which has been a sort of a litany of impending economic disasters that was being built up over that time. So it's hardly a surprise as to what's happening now. Most of us who are in the know have been saying this is exactly what's going to happen, but you can't blame it all on the virus, etc. This is a kind of gross mismanagement on the part of the government. They've underestimated the Brexit scenario quite deliberately, I'd rather suspect.
Sure.
They've underestimated the COVID aspect quite deliberately as well.
Okay. Well, I saw you nodding there, Tony Gosling, except when Simon Abbas started talking about Brexit. Then you stopped. I'm wondering why. But tell us about Brexit and promises that Boris Johnson made. He was supposed to cut the VAT on fuel bills, and he has decided not to do that. So, which is said to give this rise or be one of the factors for this rise by 54%. Why didn't Prime Minister Johnson follow through with his promise?
Well, of course, it's because Johnson is not necessarily in charge. He has to take advice of the city and his very powerful chancellor, the billionaire Rishi Sunak, the guy from Goldman Sachs. So there are all sorts of people around who've got also a very big say in what goes on. Boris he's being pulled. He's like a tug of war. He's being pulled in various different directions. Sometimes one lobby wins, another time another lobby wins. But I don't think he's a man of specific principles. He's the sort of politician who will try and go with the flow. Whichever way it seems he's going to manage to survive, he will go that way. And so when he's being pulled in this, I mean, it's absolutely right what you're saying about the horrific conditions here in Britain for ordinary people. It's been getting worse really since the 1970s. Slowly but surely, people's living standards have been eroded. Job opportunities are getting worse and worse. The unions are able less and less to keep people's wages at a reasonable level. There's increasing unemployment. There's now the expectation that both the man and the woman in a household must go to work in order to afford to pay, to buy their own home and to make sure kids go to nursery and this sort of thing. So there's massive increases on the finances. But if you look at the structural changes that have been going on, and this is the latest, this really does take the biscuit. I mean, what we've been seeing has gradually been happening over the years. But these fuel increases are a massive increase in that. It's almost an exponential rise. It's because the economy has shifted from a manufacturing and service economy into a financial economy. And what those financial economy, financialized sure. infrastructure, is all the basic things we need, things like housing, water, all the basics. Those is where there's big investment
but that's
and
been going on for a while.
But
that's been going on for a while, if I'm correct to say that, Tony Gosling, in terms of the UK turning out to become this financial focused economy where the money is made, as opposed to what it used to have, which was a lot of manufacturing jobs. But I got to ask this next question from you, say Mohsen Abbas, because it's very perplexing reading how thousands die because they can't afford heating bills in the UK. More than 2,700 people to have died each year in England and in Wales because they can't afford to keep their homes warm. And then what was more interesting was this is back in 2011. So I'm guessing that figure is higher now. Tell us how this happens and why it seems like the UK government either doesn't care or has learned to adapt to this grim fatality rate as a result, and how much worse it can get with this 54% rise in gas prices or energy prices.
Well, what they've done in Britain since neoliberalism has taken hold of this country in a full way post Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher was the one who ushered it all in back in the 80s. Since then, what we've seen is the delusion of the British, what I call, still call, the working class. Because what they were conned into believing was that they've somehow become middle class and that they were sort of part of a gravy train which could go and buy their own houses, they could go on several holidays a year, they could expect to spend what they liked in restaurants, go out and have sort of those kind of perks, which I guess people would regard as normal activities now. But of course, for the last 20 years, we've seen that wages haven't been increased, not of the average person. They might have for parliamentarians and others, but for the average person, in real terms, wages haven't gone up. Contrast that with food prices and general cost of living. That's gone up considerably. So you can see that inflation, British households naturally are being hit by inflation, and it's the highest rate of inflation for a decade, as far as I can work out from the research I've done. And, of course, that hasn't been arrested by the government. In fact, they've just been printing more money and throwing it at the problem. Now, the thing is, printing money is a habit which has been given to them by the money lenders. And I think Tony was quite right in pointing out to the real problem that Britain has is that they bought into this idea that you can basically carry on printing your way, printing money out your way out of the problems. Well, sooner or later, any economist knows that that is not going to be the reality of the solution. And until, for instance, a government stops this, and until they invest in real infrastructure, get energy resources, for instance, in this country, why on earth has no government invested in tidal energy? We're surrounded by waves in this little island, and we can produce, I think we produce something like 10% of our natural energy resources a year from tidal waves, etc., and the coast, but we haven't invested in it. We still rely on the carbon.
Well, that could be part of the green movement that or actions that is under that umbrella, maybe. I don't have information on that. But you talked about printing money, and, of course, that's a perfect recipe, Tony Gosling, for inflation, which the U.K. is experiencing. It's now a 30-year high. Source indicating it's up to about 7%. But is it – I mean, when we hear that, then I'm about to ask you, but haven't prices gone up a lot more? I talked to our correspondent just days ago, and he said price of margarine has quadrupled. I'm wondering what everyday items, how much prices have increased, something that comes at the top of your mind, which then translates to the poor and how they can't afford the amount of price increases that's occurring.
Okay, so I think that actually inflation is not being driven by the quantitative easing, the printing of money, because that's been going on for since really at least 2008, the massive bailouts of the banks that took place then. The reason is because mainly around, I think, energy prices going up, because that has a knock-on effect on everybody. So the food producers have to pay more, so the prices start to go up in the shops. That's, I think, what's causing this inflation. And I would say what we've seen over the last year or so, somewhere between 5 and 10% inflation in basic food prices, the sort of things that people need to survive. That, I think, is been the main driver of the prices going up. But I think there is a bigger problem, and that is this green agenda. We've seen, there's very good aims of the Greens, but we've seen these added extra taxes onto fuel going on because of this. And also, as Mohsin said there, the failure to invest in really good, reliable, cheap green energy like tidal energy. I live in Bristol, which has got one of the highest tidal reaches in the world, along with Newfoundland, and we could very easily have a tidal energy system here. They blocked it time and time and time again, and that's because there's not enough profits in it. There's more profits in the fossil fuel industries, and also there's a whole gravy train developed around other types of green, so-called green energy. So the green thing has been actually a major problem. For example, finding that the electricity grid in Britain can hardly deliver its energy, and we have to switch on the one coal-fired power station we've still got left in order to keep energy going. So that has also been subsidised. Sure. All this green stuff has been subsidised, which has also pushed energy prices up. Remember Henry Kissinger? He said, this is a good few years, probably 30 years ago now, he said, you control the energy, you control the nations. And these energy companies are very powerful, and they work together in concert around the Western world, as you probably know. The other thing he said, by the way, was control the food and you control the people. And so by putting food prices up, make it more difficult to get hold of food, people are being driven in further into debt and into a form of wage slavery.
Right. Well, I'd like to capitalize on what you said in the beginning of the program, Tony Gosselin. I think you mentioned it there a little bit also. And say, Mohsin Abbas, that was when Tony Gosselin talked about Shell. Now, Shell has posted its highest quarterly profits in 8 years. That's a lot. But more alarming is that there wasn't a gas shortage or a petrol shortage. They were just keeping it to drive the prices higher. That is something that is plaguing a lot of different commodities or items, I should say. Especially, for example, in the U.S. And I'm wondering if the U.K. is the same case, where because of COVID, people did not go out as much, did not purchase as much maybe, and now it's time to make the money, to make back the profits by increasing the prices even higher, which means the prices are not going to come down. Is that a correct way of looking at it, which means basically corporate greed is playing into the picture?
Very much so, and I think let's take it a step up now, because Vanguard and BlackRock, according to my research, are two companies who basically overarch most of the financial capital and the corporations of the world. Now, if we're living in the alternate reality where I'm meant to believe that there's free competition, free trade, and there's real corporations out there which are all fighting each other, then I could accept that, okay, there's a dog-eat-dog world out there. But I've increasingly started studying people like Professor Rodney Shakespeare and his take on binary economics and the solutions, and researching things like, for instance, the Bradbury Pound, which was something which Britain used as a way of kicking out the corporates, looking back at the way America once dealt with bankers as well. There is a precedent for solving these problems. And the precedent begins, first of all, with stopping the reliance on the guys who create the main debt, who use usury and use the interest mechanisms and the money system as a way of making all these things happen. And of course, energy companies and all these different corporates that fix the prices and sort of sit behind closed doors and decide what's going to happen, what's not going to happen, then they come into play. But behind it, let's take it another stage further back and look at the World Economic Forum, for example. Mr. Klaus Schwab, who has been harping on about the Agenda 2030 and the Great Reset, the Global Reset. And all of this involves the biggest transnational corporations in the world, whether there's two of them or dozens of them or whatever you believe. And it involves the state operators. These are clear-cut strategies and policies which hinge around...
I wonder if there was a bidding for that. It makes me wonder if there was a bidding for that to become part of this, as you said, great 2030 reset.
Well, yes. I mean, the thing is, if you believe in accidents and chaos in the economic world, then, of course, you just see things as a matter of symptoms and consequence and reactionary behavior. Sure. But if you start seeing that actually there are players that have power to be able to influence those the economics, i.e., they control the means of production, they control the raw materials, they can create wars where they want, they can release viruses if they wanted to create chaos around the world, and they can also create propaganda and create corporate...
I got to jump in. Unfortunately, we're just running out of time, Samuel Sanabas. I do apologize. And I figure I'm going to save this one for last, Tony Gosling. And this is what Rishi Sunak has said. The government does have a plan to help out, I guess, with the energy bills for average UK. But then he said, in terms of taxes, his mission was to cut taxes ahead of the next general election, scheduled for May 2024. Well, that's 2 years from now. How's that going to help people now?
Well, you know what? Today, Rishi Sunak has just blocked a recovery plan for the National Health Service, too. I think if I was Boris Johnson, I would sack him today, because he's clearly showing policies which are simply there to beef up the profits of the biggest companies in the City of London. For example, Shell, their 14-fold rise in profits at the same time as the energy prices are going up, for consumers, 50%.
Thank you for that. Tony Gosling, we're just out of time. I apologize. Thank you so much. It was very riveting. This was great. Tony Gosling there, Sony investigative journalist from Bristol. Thank you so much for your contribution. And Samuel Sanabas from London, thank you, journalist and political commentator, also from London there. And that is it for this edition of The Spotlight. From me, Kavitahwe, it's goodbye until next time.